So I would like to remind you to turn off your cell phones because we're going to record this talk this evening. And now let me introduce to you Professor Michael Santoro, who is one of the leading business ethicists in the United States. And lucky for us, he is also an expert on China. And his most recent book, which I just mentioned to you, China 2020, will provide many of the themes for today's discussion. But before we dive in, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about Professor Santoro. And as you can imagine, his resume is very long, but I will give you some of the highlights. Michael Santoro is an associate professor with tenure of business ethics at the Rutgers Business School. He holds a PhD in public policy from Harvard University, a JD from New York University, and an AB from Oberlin College. He has also been a Fulbright Fellow at the University of Hong Kong. Professor Santoro's first book, Profits and Principles, Global Capitalism and Human Rights in China, was widely praised and formed the basis of his testimony to the U.S. Senate Finance Committee in support of China's entry into the WTO. He is the co-editor of Ethics in the Pharmaceutical Industry, he is also a frequent commentator in the media on China and business ethics and the pharmaceutical industry, and he has appeared, among other places, in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and CNN. He is a regular blogger in the Huffington Post, and in fact, this very day, he posted a blog which was provocatively entitled, "If Google Leaves China, Will Microsoft Be Beijing's Favorite Capitalist Tool?" So with that, I think we are all impatiently awaiting more provocation from Professor Michael Santoro. Welcome.
Thank you, Pam. I want to thank you and Cynthia Miyashita and retired Colonel Paul Clark, a classmate of mine from Harvard, who I was happy to see here involved at the Commonwealth Club. For this very nice invitation to come here and address you all. I first knew Pamela from reading her dispatch. You know, I read her dispatches when I was just beginning to learn about China. There's two people in this room that are really my first teachers about China. One of them is Pamela Yatsko, who, when she was the first bureau chief for the Far Eastern Economic Review in Shanghai, wrote some of the early and more important stories on China. So it's an honor to sort of be speaking about China in her presence. And also the great John Kam, you know, still my teacher on China, you know, a great citizen of San Francisco, the head of the Dewey Hua Foundation. And John, I told you everything that I say about American business people and foreign business people in China, none of that applies to you. also, that'll tell you something about what I'm going to say. John's going to leave, and he has, depending on at what point, I'm going to just stop in my tracks and wait for his comment on what I've got to say. It'll inure to everyone's benefit if we do that. And so I hope it's very unusual for anyone to shut me up, but for John, I gladly do so when he chooses to leave. Yeah, exactly. Let me say, especially in the presence, you know, not only of John and Pamela, but of other people in the room who are really true experts about China, that I still, after writing two books, don't consider myself a China expert per se, but as Pamela tried to emphasize in my introduction, my field is business ethics. And to the extent that I have an expertise, it's as a person who examines the behavior of corporations, in the case of my research, multinational corporations, and indeed has things to say about the moral virtues or lack thereof of their behavior. Sometimes when people I had someone review my book recently who was shocked. Like, he said that this fellow is actually trying to tell companies what to do and how to behave morally. I mean, yes, that's what I do for a living, and that's the object of my research and my work. And in this book, I try to address two questions, one of which is a, strictly speaking, a business ethics question, and the other of which is more of a social science question. And the business ethics question is, how can multinational corporations behave with moral integrity in China? What is it, how should they behave in China to behave with moral integrity, given all of the issues that go on there in regard to human rights and other ethics issues? And the second issue that I've been interested in since the publication of my first book in 2000 is the question of the relationship of economic engagement with democracy and human rights. You know, and some people, in fact, have kind of simplified the argument in my first book to stand for the proposition that just allowing China to be a member of the WTO, just engaging with China in business will automatically by itself lead to democracy and human rights. And in some sense, one of the big reasons I wrote this second book 10 years later was to examine the evidence, if you will, of what the relationship is between economic engagement and human rights. And the conclusion I came to, and one of the most, I came to two important conclusions after researching and writing China 2020. One is that the answer to the second research question depends on the first ethics question, which is to say, the answer to how much economic engagement is going to lead to greater respect for human rights and democracy in China is going to, in very large measure, depend upon the ethical behavior of multinational corporations in China. There's nothing, in other words, automatic about the presence of American business or other foreign business in China and the path that China will take to greater democracy and human rights. The second big conclusion that I came to was that we are probably too complacent in the West about the trajectory of China and the outcome of China in the next 10 years, hence the title China 2020. It's remarkable to think of the fact that when the People's Republic of China celebrated its 60th anniversary in October, celebrating the anniversary of the time that Mao Zedong took power and said that China has now stood on its feet, ending 100 years of foreign domination and humiliation and disorganization, and attempting to restore China to its status its rightful status as a civilization, a proud civilization that certainly predates that of the United States and one of the great civilizations of the world. That it's been 60 years since that point, and the midpoint of that has been the beginning of the reform era. China has now lived 30 years under reform as it lived 30 years under communism. So in some ways, it's no longer a new thing. I think it's sort of sometimes when we look at China, those of us that study it and visit, we like to think of China as being new. And, there's so many new and exciting things happening in China. Those things aren't so new anymore. I learned this the hard way in an MBA class that I was teaching in Beijing. A young woman, I think it's fair to say anyone would have thought of her as a young woman, who was one of my MBA students who's Chinese. I was trying to teach a case about training managers who came of age during the Cultural Revolution. And I asked the class, I said, well, there are many Chinese students in this class. Tell us, what it was it like under communism? And this woman raised her hand and said, I'd like to answer this question, but the truth is that was before I was born. So it's been a long time under reform, and it's been a pretty steady creep, pace to pace, not to I'll let the literary illusion gather where it may. But it's been China's had very consistent growth, hovering around 10% for 30 years. The government has managed, with one notable blip in 1989 and a few other smaller blips, managed to keep discontent under control. Economic and political development, such as it is, has managed to occur in a somewhat stable fashion, as I say, with one notable hiccup. So there's a natural tendency, I think, on the part of observers from the West to think that as we look at the next 10 years, that it's pretty much going to be more of the same, that change, as it inevitably will occur, is likely to be incremental and to continue this change. And sort of, and one of the theses I put forth in China 2020 is that this is a false, that relying on the past to predict the future in China is incorrect, that in fact the next 10 years I think will be a much more dramatic, could constitute a much more dramatic break one way or another in China. I think, it's hard to I remember a few years ago, occasionally the State Department will call up people who have an interest in China, and when there are official visitors for China, they'll ask you to talk with them. And there was a young man that I spoke with who was a rising star in the legal department in China, and we spent an afternoon walking in Central Park in New York together, and he gave me his opinions, I gave him mine, and then at the end of the talk I said to him, is there something I should have asked you that I didn't ask you? And he said, yeah, what you should ask me is, how have we managed to do this? How do we keep this going? And I asked him this, and what he meant was is that it's so hard to continue this growth, to manage all of the different things that are going on within our society, that one shouldn't take it for granted that we're going to be successful at this. And in fact, it's like really hard, and that the leadership is working very hard at this, but by no means is this something that everyone should presume that we do successfully. So that's the context in which I want to sort of talk about a specific subject today, because I do think that the Google situation with China now is extremely significant. I regard this as pretty much the most significant bit of news in U.S.-China relations in about 30 years, or 20 years, shall I say. Interestingly enough, it involves a San Francisco area company that's making this news, just as 20 years ago, the last time any major company decided that it would leave China, in this case temporarily, Levi Strauss, decided to temporarily stop sourcing product in China. It's been 20 years since any large global company has taken a public stand on the issue of democracy and human rights. And I would argue that not only is this significant from a company point of view, but I think it's also the most significant relationship that any large global entity, including any state, has had with China since the early 90s, confrontational nature, since the early 90s when the United States sort of unwisely and unsuccessfully tried to use most favored nation status review to pressure China on human rights. I think since that time, there has been a kind of a consensus, if you will, a consensus about what the future of China is and what the relationship of the United States to China should be. And that consensus has pretty much, been, as far as business interests are concerned, you don't bother me, I won't bother you. And mostly, I won't bother you. And this whole relationship has been predicated upon the fact that China is going to continue to grow both politically and economically at the steady pace at which it's been growing. And so, you know, America doesn't really need any more problems in the world. And so I think that there's been a tendency, certainly on behalf of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, on behalf of most of the Obama administration, with the possible exception of the USTR, which has taken some rather dramatic steps vis-a-vis China. But there's kind of a permanent government in the United States when it comes to relationships with China, and there's like a kind of a false elite consensus, which I think we have now begun to see fall apart, and the Google situation is, I think, a signal event in that falling apart. I think it began to fall apart in November when Wen Jiabao, in a little reported episode, snubbed President Barack Obama at the Copenhagen climate talks. Wen Jiabao sent a deputy who was two levels down from himself to negotiate with President Obama. And President Obama, you know, very unusually lost his cool. He was said to remark, "Well, we can't get anything done here unless you send someone with some political authority to get things done." For Obama, that's losing your temper. Shortly thereafter, he invited the Dalai Lama to the White House, something that he pointedly decided not to do last year when the Chinese government pressured him not to do so. Comes along Google. I'll talk a bit more. I want to sort of talk, first of all, more generally about what a business ethicist would say about operating in China. For the most part, we have a kind of a blueprint in moral philosophy and business ethics for thinking about how multinational corporations should behave in a country where human rights are at issue. The blueprint came from our experience in South Africa. And, you know, as maybe some of the people in this room might recall, so, you know, some companies, you know, many companies left South Africa, you know, on the grounds that the human rights violations there were so deep and so pervasive that it was just wrong to do business there. But other companies stayed, and the ones that stayed followed the principles of the Reverend Louis Sullivan, a Philadelphia minister who formulated a set of principles for those companies that stayed in South Africa to enable them to do business in South Africa, first of all, without violating human rights and being complicit in the violation of the human rights of black South Africans, but also, you know, part of the Sullivan principles were that the companies that stayed were morally required to take active steps to promote human rights. And that's been, you know, and for most companies, that's the blueprint. And if I were, you know, in the book, one of the things I do is sort of assess the sort of performance of companies. And to the extent that you can say good things about multinational corporations, it's that they've they've adhered to the first part of the Sullivan principles, which is to say they've tried to not be complicit in human rights violations. They've taken my assessment of the second prong of the Sullivan principles, that they should do things that actively promote human rights, the kinds of things that John Kam, through his Duhua Foundation, does on a regular basis. Their performance on that score has been not even less than stellar, as I will argue and explain in a moment. I think it's been pretty much non-existent. I think that the attitude that foreign business has in China is that at most I'll not be involved in trying to be being complicit in human rights issues, but it would be unwise and dangerous and none of my business and culturally insensitive and you name the excuse to do anything else. Now, the problem for Google is that it can't even that even up until this point, Google cannot fulfill the first prong of the Sullivan principles. It is what we is what philosophers will call moral philosophers will call the problem of dirty hands. Google has dirty hands. They can't operate in China without violating human rights. It's just they, in order to operate an internet search engine based in China, they have to censor results. So there's no way that, that Google can be pure. Google's motto is don't be evil. They have to be evil. So, you know, in some sense, they're in a special situation even up until this point than other companies. So how have they coped with this? Well, they've done their best. You know, some of you may be familiar with how they censor. You know, the Chinese government doesn't actually tell you which search terms, which websites to censor. They leave it to the good judgment of the internet service providers. So what does that do if you're an eager beaver when it comes to censoring? That puts you in a psychologically difficult position, and you're going to just censor as much as you can with the hope that the Chinese and most likely censor more than the government really would require or want that you do. Google was very clever. They set up a computer in China, and they tried to access foreign websites, and they created a list of the websites that the government itself would censor as the requests went out of the country, and those are the things that they censor within China. And as well, they also put a little notice that told people when you get results, when you ask for something and you're not going to get all the results, they put a little notice that tells you that. So, you know, where is Google's motto? Well, it's no longer don't be evil. It's kind of do as little evil as possible. See if you can do some good and let them know how much evil you're doing. It's a little more complicated story than don't do evil. But and of course, obviously, this leaves us very uneasy. On a moral basis, and there's been a lot of discussion among people in my profession who are business ethicists about whether this is justifiable. You know, at the end of the day, I think the conclusions that we draw about this is that it really depends on whether, in fact, the service that Google is providing is so much better than the alternative services that in some ways it justifies the evil of censoring. It's not an ethical conclusion that most moral philosophers and most people who sort of are and people who are ethical purists are really comfortable drawing. But Google was kind of at peace with itself, and certainly they had made peace with the business ethicists, and that's where things stood until January 11th of this year. On January 12th of this year, Google posted a blog on their official website, and they announced that there had been a cyber attack in December of their computer systems. This apparently had happened to something close to 30 other American companies. Their data security was compromised. The emails of certain human rights activists were compromised, although the understanding was is that it only that the only the hackers were only able to get to the Ray line. They didn't actually see what was in the email, but they were able to see what the subject matters were. Who did this? It's sort of unclear. There have been sort of a shadowy group associated with a couple of universities that seem to have some connections with the government. It's sort of unclear yet how coordinated this was and who did it. But what's extraordinary is Google's reaction to it, which is that they decided they took it as an occasion to say, hey, maybe we shouldn't be doing business in China at all. And that sent justifiably shockwaves through the tech community. It sent shockwaves through China, and it kind of shocked me too, because I still to this day don't quite understand the connection between a security breach and revisiting the issue of censorship. But somehow within Google, that connection had been made, and they made a decision to reconsider whether doing as little evil as possible was something that they could live with. Some people have suggested, and it's purely speculation based on what I have read as his public statements on the matter, that Sergey Brin, who was one of the founders of Google, who grew up in the Soviet Union, he was born in Moscow. His father was a mathematician who couldn't get a good job in Moscow because he was Jewish, emigrated to the United States. That Sergey Brin, has a kind of a special, how do I put it? That this is his issue. That censorship is something that he's promoting. Although if you actually read his public statements on these, he's somewhat less bullish and enthusiastic about these human rights issues than the speculation would seem to suggest. In any event, Eric Schmidt, the president and CEO of Google, has just a few days ago said that this is going to come to a conclusion. Maybe as we're speaking, the headlines are 99.9% certain that Google will leave China. The Minister of Industry and Information Technology in China, which is, there's, as you might imagine, those of you who follow Chinese politics, can well imagine all the jockeying around to see who's going to regulate the internet, and about five or six different agencies, have all had their Al Haig moments and asserted jurisdiction over the internet. This is one of them. Said very pointedly, look, there's going to be no compromise. You follow Chinese law, Google, or leave. Now, one of the popular we're at, I think, an extraordinary moment. I mean, this is a big deal. Google leaving China will be a big deal. I think actually it will be. I think it's a big deal for Google. And I think it's going to be an even bigger deal for China. One of the misconceptions I think that people have about this is that it's not a big deal for Google, and it's not a big deal for Google because they're supposedly not doing very well in China. In fact, nothing could be farther from the truth. Google is doing extremely well in China, and they've been doing extremely well lately. Even when they were supposedly not doing very well, which is, in July of 2009, they had a 30% market share compared to the 68% market share of Baidu, which is the local Chinese product. Incidentally, Yahoo, Microsoft, Bing, whatever they are up there, had less than 2%. In January of this year, just before Google made its announcement, the consulting firm StatCounter said that Google's market share in China had risen from 30% in July to 43% in December, and that Baidu was at 56%, and Bing, Yahoo, Microsoft were still under 2%. China, so Google is threatening to leave China precisely at the moment when it is winning in the marketplace, winning in a market that, 338 million internet users, the largest internet in the world, winning in a market where there are $3 billion a year already in advertising revenue on the internet, $1 billion already for internet search engines. This is a big deal for Google. This is not a small – it's no small matter to leave China, and no one should be under the impression that they're leaving because they're not doing well. Now, why are they doing well? The first is because they have a superior product. You know, one of the first things I saw when I got off the plane here in San Francisco were some bright young people with Google T-shirts on, walking around them very proudly. And, you know, Google is one of the great companies in America, and they have one of the smartest workforces in America. It's, how big a deal is it to work at Google? Well, he shall remain unnamed, but a law school classmate of mine, whose son graduated from Dartmouth last year, every time I talk to him, tells me about how proud he is of his son who got a job at Google. You know, Google has become even more desirable than working at Goldman Sachs, if you can imagine it. It is like, you know, they are getting the best and the brightest, and, you know, anybody who's traded in their iPhone for a Droid will also tell you that they're extending their brand into all kinds of areas. It should be no shock that they're providing a really high quality service in China, because this represents the apex of the American economy. It represents the apex of our college graduates, of our MBA graduates, of our managerial talent, of our technical talent. Like, of course they're going to be doing we may not be able to make a decent we may not be able to manufacture certain kinds of goods at a globally competitive price, and this has created problems for the American economy in our manufacturing sector. But if there is one area where we clearly have a dominant global comparative advantage, and which must be the engine for future economic growth in this country, it's our technology, and Google is at the very apex of that comparative economic power. Apart from being technically better, I have to believe, and there's no way really I can prove this, but I believe it, that there has to be something to the fact that the results that people are getting on the Google search engine are better and censor less. I was at a gathering recently where someone had mentioned that a friend of hers who was a journalist in China, she asked her, like, well, what's your reaction to Google's closing? And the journalist said, I'm devastated because I'm not going to be able to find the information that I want to be able to do my job. I mean, and so part of Google's marketplace success is not just that they provide a technically better product, but I have to believe that more and more Chinese internet surfers are going to Google CN because they know they're going to get better results for their searches. Now, does this mean that tens of millions and hundreds of millions of ordinary Chinese are interested in politics and human rights and are looking for these kinds of things on the internet? No. Obviously. In China, just like in the United States, most people are concerned about their relationships, their jobs, the day-to-day aspects of their lives. But still, it filters, you know, I have to believe that sort of the ultimate freedom of the greater freedom of the internet search in Google is going to have to make a choice in the internet service provider and search engine that Chinese people use. I'm very struck by how very much this whole story is a San Francisco story. All of these companies that I'm talking about, as it happens, Levi Strauss, Google, these are all companies that are based in the Bay Area. And here too, I'm also very conscious of the fact that I'm a person of Sicilian heritage who comes here to San Francisco to talk about human rights, and I'm reminded of another Sicilian who came from New York City to Sproul Plaza at Berkeley during the free speech movement, and I can't help drawing the comparison between Mario Savio and Google. You know, it's kind of an odd thing these days, you know, that so much of the action when it comes to ethics and global ethics is now resides in kind of the behavior of multinational corporations. And I can't help thinking of, you know, as I think of Google deciding that maybe they've had enough in China, I can't help hearing the words of Mario Savio echoing that, saying that, you know, sometimes, he said, the machine becomes so sickening that you can't be a part of it anymore. You know, maybe, you know, in the boardrooms of Google and in the board and in the polite society of CEOs, it's not quite as dramatic and with the passion that Mario Savio spoke at Sproul Plaza, but the principles, I think, are the same ones that are at stake. I want to say a brief word about the other companies. That is to say, the companies, because part of the reason I'm so astounded at what Google is doing is because what the other companies are doing, I think, is so dismal and so minimal. And I'll give my case in brief by talking about the rule of law in China. As a condition of China's entry into the WTO, as part of the accession agreement, China agreed to what every other country agrees to when they become part of the WTO, which is that they will provide a legal mechanism by which foreign companies can, if necessary, sue the government and do business in that country. It's part and parcel of being part of the international trading system that you will agree that when companies invest in your company, in your country, that you will have a fair and just legal system where these companies can, if necessary, go before a judge and have a rule or a regulation interpreted not according to the way the government, you know, the regulators might interpret it, but according to law. And this is true. This isn't just true for the United States and Western Europe. This is true in India, in Argentina, and every other country in the world. Not just that's a part of the WTO. It's not a rich man, rich woman principle. And any lawyer who's practiced in any of these other countries will know that very often if you are in Argentina or you're in India and a government regulator is hassling you about something, that you try to, like just as in the United States, you try to work it out through mediation by talking with them, just as you would try to do it in China. There's nothing about the existence of this principle that suggests that you have to be litigious at every moment about everything that you do. But every lawyer knows that if you have to, if the regulator is being unreasonable, one of the things you could do is go into court and ask the judge to say, look, the regulator is being unreasonable. They're not applying the law correctly. In fact, it's the ability to do that that makes the conversation between regulators and companies useful, because the regulators know that that's something that you could always resort to in the event that they're really acting in a completely arbitrary and capricious manner. So when China acceded to the WTO in 2000, the Supreme Judicial Court adopted regulations for allowing companies to engage in foreign companies to engage in these kinds of lawsuits. And lo and behold, the system they created was that the companies would participate in the same courts, the very same courts, that ordinary Chinese citizens use to petition the government when they have a problem with the government. It's now 2010. In the 10 years that those provisions have been in effect, not one foreign company has sued any level of the Chinese government for anything. What does that tell you? And it tells you that they're resolving their problems in a different way. The smart way to resolve your problems in China is through your relationships. You cultivate your relationships with government officials. Everyone knows that. It would be unwise to ever sue the Chinese government. And so, in fact, one lawyer called me exceedingly loony for even suggesting such a thing. But what does that do? What does that do to the rule of law when ordinary Chinese citizens who can't afford a decent lawyer and have to represent themselves and themselves are afraid of retaliation are using the same courts, and rich corporations that can afford the richest lawyers are too afraid to sue about anything ever. You know, clearly that is cowardly, and clearly that's an abdication of responsibility. And it's also not doing China a lot of good either, because it's an area where foreign companies, I think, could make a big difference in the development of the rule of law and the course of China. So this is why Google's action is so extraordinary. And the stakes, I think, are very, very high. For China, their continued political and economic development, I think, can only go so far if the rule of law doesn't develop, if there's not an open internet, if there are not standards for safe products. This is a country where 700 million people are still living on less than a dollar a day, the World Bank's official level for poverty. And that's, less than a dollar a day, 700 million people in China are still living under less than a dollar, with less than a dollar a day. This is a country where if they are not successful in developing an internal economy to parallel the growth that they've had in exports, will not be able to continue the growth upon which their whole political and economic structure is based today. And that development, I do not believe, will occur unless there is progress in areas like the rule of law and internet freedom. There are high stakes for investors, I think. Does anybody really want to invest their money in a country where your long-term interests cannot be protected through legal right, but where your interests can only be protected by establishing good relations with the people who happen to be in power in a country whose political future is uncertain? Follow the money, as they said during the Watergate era. There's a lot of foreign investment in China, but it's all pretty short term. There are very few foreign companies that are investing. The notable exceptions are maybe the automobile companies, but there's very little long-term investment in China by foreigners. Most foreign investment in China is still focused on the manufacturing industry and related to exports. I think that the money bears out, the money is telling you what the money is telling you, I think, what the real estimations of China's futures are, real estimation of China's future. For the United States, I think we have big stakes as well here, because we have to get this right. I think that we've been, I liken the period that we just went through with China to the period of detente. I'm closing here, by the way, Pam. I know you're looking at it. I liken the period that we've just gone through with China to the period of detente that existed between the United States and the Soviet Union before the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and it led to kind of one of the more unstable periods of the Cold War. And that is, I think that it's all well and good to engage with each other and to be friendly, but when we pretend that we don't have differences and we're afraid to to address those differences, then I think that that becomes very dangerous. And make no mistake about it, you know, up until November, this administration has been very reluctant to create another problem in China, is the way they would look at it. But the way I would look at it is just have an adult conversation about our differences. We have two high-level committees that are meant to address economic and security issues between China. They meet every 6 months regularly, and they never discuss anything. They just sort of smile, and then 2 or 3 months later, something will flare up. We have to get to, you know, we have to get to a point in our U.S.-China relations where our differences, and in this case, our trade differences, our very, you know, our very real trade differences, you know, the success, the, you know, Google's leaving China is not just a human rights issue. It's an economic issue, and it's a jobs issue. And let me close by saying one other thing. It's like, if they can hear me in Redmond, Washington, Microsoft should not try to grow in China at the expense of Google's human rights stand. The Chinese government would like nothing better than to tell the world, see, Google left, but somebody else came along and wants a piece of the cake, and they're willing to behave the way we want them to behave. So as you follow this story, it's going to go up the road to Washington, up the California coast to Washington, and watch Microsoft very, very closely, because I believe they have a responsibility to stand with Google on this one. And that if they don't, they should be condemned for that. And I'll be let me be, as I think I am, the first one to do it prospectively. We're watching you in Redmond, Washington. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Professor Santoro for giving us a very interesting, provocative talk this evening. And now it's time for any of you who have questions.
I just want to say one thing. I don't know why the truth is so provocative.
Well, I understand your position of not having Microsoft not granting the Chinese liberty to demand for more and have them to show someone else who are willing to compromise under my rule. But how does the lack of information affect the Chinese citizen? How without a giant search engine like Google, average citizen, it's going to be hard for them to obtain any sort of information that. How would this affect them?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it's no doubt one of the things that Google thought about before they left, which was, you know, the conclusion that I drew earlier, which is that, you know, as much as they don't have pure hands in China, on balance, they provided a service that was not there before. And now the questioner, I think, is very rightly saying, asking, doesn't Microsoft have a duty, you know, in a way to kind of step in and provide this service that Google is not providing anymore? And I think that's a fair consideration, but I think whatever good can be accomplished that way, I think is outweighed by the good that can be accomplished if Microsoft stands with Google. I mean, just think about it. Think about what kind of a statement it would make to the Chinese government, to the Chinese people, that Google and Microsoft, neither of them wants to be there. That both of them said, you know, I just can't participate in this anymore. I think that I guess my feeling is that if I thought that that's where things were going to stay and that there would be no movement after that, then I would say, well, you know, maybe Google should have stayed, maybe Microsoft should go in. But I think that I think that there's something very dramatic going on here, and And Microsoft, I think, will be mostly an enabler if they don't stand with Google. That is, they'll be an enabler of censorship. You want to say more? Go ahead. God, I've forgotten that there was a company called AOL, but go ahead. This was so long ago.
And now Google initially went into China under certain conditions, but now they have grown such a large market in China. So would Microsoft potentially be the next Google, and they could make another stir if they compromise first and then the system
Okay, let me try this another way. Isn't there something a little unseemly about a company that has a 2% market share stepping in and taking over when a company with a 43% market share leaves because of human rights concerns? I mean, I just don't think you need a PhD. Like, I don't think you need a PhD in moral philosophy to kind of think that one through. It just is. I mean, we could spend a little more time thinking it through, and of course we shall. It's so obviously the wrong thing to do. I mean, if Microsoft wants to earn market share in China or anywhere else, there's a way to do it. Create a better product and compete with Google technologically, which I think they're capable of doing. There are lots of smart people up there, and I'm sure that they can hire smart young Dartmouth graduates and Stanford graduates just like Google and do it the old-fashioned way, which is to compete over quality and price. I think that this is just unfair. This would be unfair for Microsoft to do.
Yeah, towards the middle to towards the end of last year, I recall reading an article that essentially said Walmart could have certain standards, corporate social responsibility standards in China, but if they violated it, they would not be prosecuted here in the U.S. And it was really a profound article. It was like page 3 or 4. It wasn't a front page thing. I wish I kept it, but I'm curious if you had seen that or heard anything about that.
I'm sorry, standards about labor?
Labor, yeah, corporate social responsibility, and it was almost like a double standards that, you know, they are immune here in the U.S. from any, court legal action, but over there they could uphold to their standards and look great on both fronts.
Yeah, this is very interesting. If I may answer this in a this is one of the, among business ethicists, this is what you've raised is kind of one of the sort of most difficult questions we're dealing with right now, and that is like what should be, how should we think about corporate social responsibility efforts in the first place, like voluntary efforts by companies? How far can you go in accomplishing the goals of global justice by expecting companies to adhere voluntarily to corporate social responsibility's principles, particularly in the context of what many people sort of talk about as sort of one of the results of one of the attributes of globalization, which is the decline of the nation state in general, and also in particular in developing countries, the unwillingness of nation states to enforce principles of global justice. So, I hope that you understand why I'm addressing this question at that kind of level, because it kind of raises, I think, the question that you're raising, I think, is one that it's one of the more interesting areas to think about, and I'm not quite sure. I don't have my mind made up about it. What you've described as a problem is that in some ways, we are, all of these companies, Google, Walmart, Microsoft, they're the new governments. They're colossuses, some people have said. And who's governing them? What power do citizens have of one country or another to get them to behave in a way that accords with what's good for society, what's good for the world. It's going to be a long time before we have a world government that's going to be able to do this. And so in the meanwhile, how far do voluntary efforts go? And we're living in a very our ways of holding multinational corporations accountable are highly imperfect. I mean, when we're relying on professors like me to have any impact on this at all, then that tells you how Procrustean our abilities to control multinational corporations are. I mean, we're in a very low level of control over multinational corporations.
I'm sure you and I, and I guess probably most of us in the room, would like multinational companies in China to behave morally, and probably more morally than in fact they do. But how would you reply to a CEO of a multinational company active in China if he came along to you and said, let us keep working in China, let us keep operating in China. China is growing economically very rapidly. In the course of time, as most other countries, apart from the oil states, as China modernizes, it's going to become a more liberal country, perhaps one day also a democracy. What's your reply to the standard business defense for their presence actually in China? And perhaps the second question related to that, you hinted in your early remarks that you weren't very optimistic about how things in China might turn out over the next 10 or 20 years. Would you like to elaborate on that point as well, please?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks.
On the first question, I would say that you're unless you do a little more than just you're betting against yourself. In other words, that's a nice thought, but it's very complacent, and it's complacent not just about how China is going to develop, but it's also complacent about what's in your best business interest. I think that the CEO would like to think that the best way to behave in China is like a turtle and to stick your head out, like, very rarely. But in fact, that I believe that that's ultimately dangerous for your investment, and you do need to be involved. You do need to be involved in shaping the legal structure, in shaping the regulatory structure and the standards for safety, product safety and product quality. It has to be more than something very passive. On the second question, I wouldn't say that I'm pessimistic about China's future. I would simply say that we tend to underestimate the possibility I would say two things. Number one, that I think we're going to have a corner solution. In other words, I think that things will resolve themselves dramatically, either in a very positive way or a very negative way, and the business of muddling along isn't going to occur. Even though it has turned out that way for 30 years, I think it's a mistake to think that there's not going to be a dramatic break one way or the other. Do I think that – am I pessimistic about that dramatic break? No. I would say that we're just underestimating the probabilities and the possibilities of things going negative. I don't like to put a number on such things, but the Chinese often, there's often a conversation about how good was Mao, like 70%, so in the spirit of the Chinese willingness to sort of put numbers on unfathomable concepts, I'd say something, if I were going to put a probability on it, I'd say maybe it was 20% the negative scenario, which Colonel Clark will recall from our Kennedy School days is actually like quite high. In other words, it sounds low, but 20% probability of a very bad outcome is a high probability. It doesn't mean that I think it's going to happen. And just so that everyone should understand, it certainly does not mean that I think it should happen or I want it to happen. Quite the contrary, I feel that what I'm advocating and the things that I'm saying are meant to be in friendship to China. And this isn't about just the United States and U.S. interests. I believe it's in China's interest to adhere to some, for foreign companies to adhere to the principles I've been talking about. Denise.
I guess I'm next. Don't you think, in terms of talking about the voluntary initiatives of corporations, that Google has the huge opportunity to set the bar for other multinationals? Set the bar. In other words, to say, okay, this is it. We're going to say no. Don't you think other corporations are going to have a bit more courage or confidence to say, ooh, maybe we could do that too? Do you think that's possible?
Professor Kleinrichert is one of the rising stars in the business ethics field, and you're lucky to have her here in San Francisco. And but if I may call you Denise,
<That's right.
laughs> yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that I'm sort of talking in very. I think you're right to point out that I'm speaking not only in moral terms, but you being trained as a moral philosopher, you might even think of me as speaking moralistically. But you know, there is a leadership aspect to this. I think you're right to point that out, and I think it is one of the exciting things about this. If only you know. In the next few days, we're going to find out. It will be very disappointing if some unhappy compromise results in these last few days. But we'll watch it very carefully. You know, but very clearly, as Professor Kleinrichert is pointing out, you know, what we're watching here in Google is an example of moral leadership. If it happens, and I would like to add to that thing, I'm expecting more of the same from Microsoft.
But isn't there some risk that some of these other multinationals that are not being internet search will sort of draw the distinction between McDonald's or Coca-Cola or Walmart and say, yeah, but our business of selling hamburgers or Coca-Cola or retail goods, it's different in that you're not, really enabling.
Yeah. Again, you go back to the Sullivan principles, and very clearly, those companies are who behave that way are fulfilling the first prong, which is that they're not themselves being complicit. But the second part of operating in a country where these kinds of operating responsibly in a country where there are these kinds of issues is that you do take some initiatives. McDonald's is a really good example of a company that could get bit by this and that has. I mean, there was a report that went around. I tell the story in the book that a report somehow a local newspaper published a muckraking report that suggested that Microsoft was not paying that McDonald's was not paying minimum wage. That they were somehow taking advantage of their workers, and this became a big local issue in a southern province. And a McDonald's lawyer showed up in southern China in the city where this was going on, and he did what any other lawyer would say: "Can I find out more information about this?" And he was threatened with going to jail. Really what amounted to completely illegal and extrajudicial attempts to put pressure on McDonald's. And that was a very good cautionary tale for what can happen to companies that don't, in essence, invest in the rule of law, is they can take this away from you. Is anybody going to be shocked 10 years from – I mean, let me sort of paint the scenario the way it would go, like just to give a sense of how it might get animated. Like – China's economic miracle can I don't want to say it can turn on a dime, but we tend to overestimate that China is a global economic power. Remember, this is a country where 700 million people are still living in a global definition of poverty. If they don't make a successful transition from the export economy to an internally driven economy, and their growth figures aren't 10% anymore, but start going into 7%, or maybe they even go into a recession for a year or two. The only way the government is going to be able to keep that situation under control is by keeping the voices in that country under control. And one of the ways they're surely going to do this is the way they've done it in the past, is through xenophobia. They're going to, you know, foreign companies are going to, you know, in that kind of a scenario, foreign companies and foreign investment is going to be attacked. At that point, many of these companies are going to wish, if it in fact happens, and I think there's a high probability, that's a high probability event of their economy slowing down and people beginning to ask questions about foreign investment. In that event, these companies are going to wish that they had invested in the rule of law today and tomorrow and in the next year or two when they had a chance to do something about it. Did that answer your question? Or? Yes.
What's your take on Yahoo? I mean, do you think they're going to step in on the plate? And what about the Chinese Central Bank? Where do they play into this?
Yeah, that. Thank you for asking about that, because that's another shibboleth about U.S.-China relations, which is that China owns us now because they're buying our bonds. Let me, you know, on the Yahoo, very good. I mean, I don't know, are Yahoo and Microsoft even separate companies? I mean, they're all small. I mean, all of them are small players, and yes, they all need to coordinate together. So, you know, again, all, you know, right now it's Baidu and Google, and everybody else is tiny. On the second question, I'd like to address this issue of, you know, that this is like, you know, we like to simplify things in America. You know, we like to tell a simple story, and the simple story that we like to tell now about China is that they own us because, and we can't tell them what to do because they buy our bonds and they buy our treasury securities. And I thought, actually, I wrote a piece in the Huffington Post about this. I thought it was like highly unseemly that Secretary Clinton, when she took her first trip to China, you know, sort of was telling the Chinese, you should buy American bonds because they're good investments. And we behave that way. We allow ourselves, you know, one of the reasons our foreign policy towards China is so poor is that our leaders don't get it. You know, they don't even understand the right dynamics. They think China owns us. They don't. There's an old saying that, you know, if you look, I forget exactly how it goes, but if you owe somebody like a dollar, like they're, you know, you're a borrower. You know, if you owe them $100, you know, you're something. You know, if you owe them $1,000, you're partners. You know, China is very definitely our partner. You know, and make no mistake about it. If they had a better place to park their foreign reserves, they would. They're not buying U.S. Treasuries because Secretary Clinton is asking them to nicely. They're doing it because they don't have anything better to do with their money. And in fact, the few times they've tried to do anything with it, they've lost a lot of money in futures, in commodities futures. And like they've lost, you know, it's one of the untold stories of China's foreign reserve investments is every time they've tried to do anything other than buy U.S. treasuries, they've squandered the money away. So yeah, they're sitting there, they're saying like, they're gnashing their teeth. They're saying, boy, I'd like to, you know, do something other than prop up American lending, and make no mistake about it, the minute they can, they will. But, you know, do they own us? Do they have power over us as a result? No more power over us than we have over them for being the place that where virtually all of their economic growth is coming from, that being the West and that being exports. You know, we... I don't blame the Chinese at all for pressing their superior, you know, if somebody comes up to you and says, you know, and you're negotiating with someone and you can sense that person, you know, thinks that you're very powerful, you just shut up and you play into that. That's what the Chinese are doing. I blame our negotiators because they're so inexperienced. We have, you know, you know, our idea of being knowledgeable about China is, you know, to work a few years at an investment bank, you know, attend a few seminars, you know, luncheon seminars at the Asia Society, and poof, like, you know, we'll make you an assistant secretary and send you over to China to negotiate a treaty against someone, you know, like, you know, and or, you know, never mind, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, when he negotiated with Wu Yi, who was an extremely seasoned Chinese negotiator. She, you know, she famously was the person who said, you know, China's a big piece of cake. You know, the people who come first will get the biggest slice. Extremely smart, knows America inside out, has negotiated with American negotiators over two decades. Henry Paulson, sitting across the table from her, is a mismatch. You know, she just ran circles around him. And, you know, before the meeting even began, you know, they start, you know, the Chinese negotiators put things in the papers to put the American negotiators on notice that they better not be too tough with us, because you're imposing, you know, you can't keep China down, and how terrible that would be. And we're just, you know, we just don't have, I don't blame the Chinese negotiators. They're merely pressing the advantage that we're giving to them. But I think we need to have better China experts in our government, particularly on the side that's negotiating over economics. This is why we get into these problems, is because we're not sophisticated enough to work out a solution before it becomes something very dramatic like this. You know, this issue of internet freedom, this should have been on the agenda of the economic and security summits a year ago. There are provisions in our trade agreements that we could have pressed on these issues, and instead we just let the thing fester.
So I'm afraid that is going to have to be our last question, but I think we'd all like to thank Professor Santoro for this really provocative and interesting discussion. And his books are on sale, and he's here to sign them if you should buy a copy or have a copy. So with this, the meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.